Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome, and thank you all for joining this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm your host, Ashley Kobovich, Regional Director at CREXI. And today, we are thrilled to sit down with Paul Massey, CEO and founder of B6 Real Estate Advisors. Before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. Paul Massey was born in Boston, Massachusetts, where he attended the Roxbury Latin School. He graduated from Colgate University with a Bachelor of Arts in Economics in 1983. Mr. Massey began his career at CBRE and soon became the head of Market Research Department in Midtown Manhattan, then as an investment sales broker. He founded Massey Knackel Real Estate Services with his colleague Robert A. Knackel, whom he met at CBRE. The company became the New York metropolitan area's dominant commercial investment sales brokerage firm, with over 225 employees serving more than 200,000 property owners. Massey Knackel Realty Services was consistently ranked New York's number one investment sales firm in volume for 14 consecutive years. As CEO of Massey Knackel, he led the development of the firm's strategic initiatives, including geographic expansion, as well as the growth of the firm's service lines. At the end of 2014, Cushman & Wakefield acquired Massey Knackel, and Mr. Massey was appointed President, New York Investment Sales. In 2017, Paul Massey ran as mayoral candidate for New York City, primarily focusing on education, housing, and homelessness while providing solutions for improving quality of life in the city. In July 2018, Mr. Massey and his partners launched a new commercial brokerage firm, B6 Real Estate Advisors, short for Building by Building, Block by Block. The investment sales and capital advisory firm specializes in middle market, $1 to $200 million. The firm employs a distinct territory network model that ensures its agents' sub-market expertise, an owner-aligned philosophy, and technology-forward platform. Mr. Massey is a member of numerous organizations, including REBNY and the Lower East Side Tenant Museum. He is also an amateur boxer and an avid skier. He and his wife, Gretchen, have three children, a son, Paul III, and daughters, Sarah and Greta. He resides in Larchmont, New York. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
Of course. We're so excited to have you. So I know we just covered a little bit about your background, but I'd love to hear it from you yourself. So tell us more about where you're from and how you first got started in commercial real estate.
Got in real estate by pure luck. I was was involved with my fraternity in college, and there was an alum who was supposed to come by a couple times a year and make sure we weren't burning the house down. And it turns out that he was a national accounts officer at CBRE. Okay. And he got me a summer job at CBRE, and I absolutely loved it.
Didn't look back after.
No, and it had a bit of a windy road, but when I got done with school, I went running back to CB, and they wouldn't hire me in Boston because the office was pretty full, and they weren't going to roll the dice on college kid, which was really upsetting to me because I immediately knew I loved the company. It's still a great company. It's the best. And they said, well, that's the bad news. The good news is we're brand new in New York City, and we'll take anybody down there. And being so qualified, and I had gone to school in upstate New York, so yep. A lot of my classmates were coming to New York. But my initial grand plan was 6 months, 9 months in New York, and then back to Boston to get the job I thought I really wanted. And that plan just didn't last long.
Sure.
Immediately fell in love with New York. It was, in a way, an extension of college and all that was good. but also CB was fantastic. So I ended up meeting Bob Knackle, who I started our first business with. And we did 4.5 years at CB before we launched our own thing.
I love it. So kind of came into commercial real estate by happenstance, didn't look back, came into New York City by happenstance, didn't look back, and then, you know, met your co-founder of your first company right there. So that's awesome. Now tell us a little bit more about some mentors and maybe lessons that they taught you early on or later.
I think the first mentors was the guy who got us the job at CBRE, or got me the job. He also got Bob Knackle his job in New York. He was the fraternity connection again.
Okay.
We didn't, Bob and I didn't know each other. Bob went to Penn, but we both were involved with the same fraternity at different schools. And this guy was a fixture as a part of that fraternity. He was also a fixture and a veteran CBRE national accounts guy. Mm-hmm. So he had a hand in getting us into CB and was always around and always looking out for us there. So he was great.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So what were some of the lessons that you learned early on that kind of became pivotal in your career?
We did a whole bunch of learning the hard way. By making every mistake in the book. You know, I think Bob was 27 and I was 28 when we started Massey Knackle, and absolutely too young and dumb to know any better, which was had its pluses and minuses.
That has a pros and cons. Yeah. You know, you take the risk, you move forward, and obviously it worked out. But
I always say we should have stuck around at CBRE and really considered how they managed and how they ran a business. But we were just stubborn and threw ourselves out there. And you know, at first we had. You know, the early lessons were we had an executive assistant who we asked to run the books of our nascent, you know, thing. And she was wonderful. Her name was Tammy. And every month we'd hand her the bills, and every month they were paid. And but then the first recession hit in 1989, 1990. And, you know, we were spending... You know, it was small potatoes at the time, but I think it was costing us 10 or 15 grand a month to run the business. And then the recession hit and velocity slowed down, and revenue slowed way down. I think in 1990 we sold two buildings, and they were both less than $2 million. So it was rough.
Yeah.
And so we were operating off our credit cards quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And then one day she came into our office. We were in one office, she was in the one next door, with like a hand pile filled of papers. Turns out to be that she had never really understood how to balance a checkbook, had never really done any bill paying or bookkeeping before, and she was really upset. And she said, these are all the bills that I haven't paid, and when I got confused or it was complicated, I just stuffed them in my drawer. so we sat down and figured it out. I think we owed $50,000 out of the blue of things that we hadn't anticipated that we were paying.
Sure.
And we scratched our way through that. But I think maybe big lesson number one is delegate, but verify.
You know? Yep. So yep. Absolutely.
She was great, but, I took over at that point.
So how did you guys figure that out? What did you do to ensure that those bills were paid, especially in such a rough time?
Well, we actually went out to a couple of clients and said, you know, we have calculated that we probably need a loan to get through this recession. And one client was just like, I have no interest. Another client was like, well, sure, I'll take half your company. My stepfather, my wife's stepdad, was a commercial mortgage broker. His name was Jack Haller. He was a big broker in New York City and operating in New Jersey as well. We went to him and said, "Hey, you know, would you lend us $75,000? we'll pay you back. And by the way, we'll give you 10% of our business if, you know, if everything works out. And he said, I'll give you the money because I know you're going to pay me back. But I don't want any part of your business. And we were looking at him like, why don't you want any part of the business? And he said, well, if I'm not working side by side with you and you're going to send me checks for the rest of your life, which is, I think, what would likely happen, you're going to end up resenting me and I just want to be friends. And Bob Knackle, if you say Jack Holler's name to Bob, he will well up and start crying.
I have chills. I'm going to start crying.
because we never thought anyone would be that generous. But right. Jack was a fixture in our life for a long time and was a fantastic guy. He passed away, but you know, he was a special person to us, not just for the loan, but because he was always he was a great mentor. Talking
sure.
about mentors,
yeah.
But that got us through the first one.
That's awesome. I mean, yeah. You said a lot right there. Biggest lesson learned, you know, delegate but verify, right? So making sure that you're doing that, but then also getting creative with, you know, adversity, right? And hardship and going out to your network and, you know, finding those good people and surrounding yourself with them and not being able to or not being afraid to reach out. So that's awesome. I love hearing that story.
Yeah, it's that very Winston Churchill thing about when you're going through hell, keep going.
Keep going. Yeah. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Paul, will you share any of your favorite transactions throughout your career? So any deals that you've done, and then why was it your favorite and what made it so unique?
As Bob and I evolved, and this was, I think, a fantastic thing. We both started the same way. We both grew up super modestly, wanted the same things, ran the business as the two-headed Hydra. for many, many years, but ultimately kind of drifted in different directions. Bob was the ultimate salesperson and biggest producer, and I loved the build, the management, the day-to-day. Mm-hmm. So my favorite transactions were more the young people whose careers we had a hand in. I think everyone makes their own career entirely, but I think you can have a hand in helping them, and that's immensely gratifying. So I think my biggest transactions are all the people that are out there that enjoyed their career with us at their first business and our second business, and people in the industry who we know and love.
For sure. I love that, and I think that making sure that you're instilling some sort of greatness, right, so to speak, and not saying that with a big head, but instilling some greatness in people. And sometimes they just need to realize their potential, right? It's there and they just need a hand holding or a push to realize that for themselves. So is there any one specific person or couple that you've helped or kind of shown how good they can be, so to speak, or kind of had a hand in that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, it was particularly gratifying to coach. You know, this is going to sound weird, but Coach Bob and James Nelson, one of our prolific star partners, and all of them really. And a lot of that coaching involved them coming up to me and saying, hey, I've got a puzzle. I think I know what the answer is, but.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that conversation and partnering ended up really just being holding up a mirror to them.
For sure.
And letting them have the conviction of what they had already figured out, probably. But it made them more confident.
Yep.
I think everybody, a lot of them, liked being part of everyone's world.
Absolutely. And, you know, every single person who is a big name in New York City real estate pretty much had their start with you guys. So that's just fantastic to see. James was here yesterday. You know, a lot of folks that came from Massey Knackle, you guys did something so, so well. And every single person that you guys have worked with and kind of trained and coached has gone on to make a huge name for themselves. So there's something to be said about the way that you guys ran that business, which is awesome.
Mm.
Perfect. We'd be remiss if we didn't discuss your political career. So can you tell us about running for mayor? What drove you to that decision to run for office?
Well, it was a point in time that was unique because we had Rudy Giuliani for 8 years as the mayor at a time that the city needed its butt kicked, and that he's that mm-hmm. guy, and was really, really effective at that moment in time. And then no one would have thought that he would be succeeded by Michael Bloomberg for 12 years. So we had 20 years of different personalities, different styles, but like strong leaders. And then we had the next mayor who I didn't think, you know, had that same focus and drive. And that was just, that coincided with us having sold our business, settling in at Cushman & Wakefield, and me thinking, boy, I'd love that job. Mm-hmm. And I viewed the mayor job, and I think all big city mayor jobs, as more of a, like a CEO job. Mm-hmm. And I think I would have loved it. And so I started playing around with exploring what that might look like to run, to be, to take that job. And Cushman & Wakefield was very benevolent about that. We had a 3-year contract to stay there after we sold the business. And they heard I was playing around with this idea, and they really encouraged it. They were very politically wired, especially their D.C. office was politically wired. And they came to me and said, you know, that this is community service, it's leadership. It won't kill us on the PR side either. Mm-hmm. So we're going to amend your contract and say you don't have to work here. The 3-year contract was you had to show up, and there was a back payment on the business and to ensure that you wanted to keep coming to work. But sure. They said you don't have to come to work anymore. You'll still get your back payment as long as you're running for office, which I did full time for about a year and 2 or a year and 3 months. Mm-hmm. And that was so I'm grateful to them for that. I also loved the experience of running for office. I mm-hmm. used to think I was Mr. New York because our first company had offices in every borough and teams in every neighborhood. And, you know, we were operating in those markets. But until you really get out there mm-hmm. on the political side and really listening to people about what's going on in their community, you really don't know the city as well as I've come to know it. And that was just an invaluable once in a lifetime. People up and down the food chain, great time.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you can think that you know a city and walk around it and see all the buildings and know all the owners, but it's so different speaking with the actual people and hearing what their problems are and how you can potentially help them. Mm. So talk us through what the campaign process was like. So that year and couple months, what was the process like? Were there any key challenges or surprising moments that you had? And, you know, what did you learn overall from the experience?
Couple of fundamental things. We and they're very, politics is arcane in some ways, but first of all, I ran as a Republican without a lot of thought. My grandfather was a Republican. I thought he was a cool guy. That was my party affiliation, but didn't really do the math on that. And there are only a couple hundred thousand Republicans in New York. So, you know, as much as they would have wanted to, there wasn't a groundswell of support. And it's probably fundamentally I'm probably more like a left centrist Dem in my heart in terms of like pro social everything and
sure.
But you know, financially responsible. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think there should be a centrist party for 85% of us, but that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah.
But the process was really good. Also, campaign finance is difficult. So I elected not to take, there's a matching funds program. So if you raise $2 million, the city gives you 12, and then you have 14 million, but you're capped at the 14 million spend, which sounds like a lot of money, but that's like a really super modest media sure. campaign in New York. And I said, I'm going to raise $30 million, double the amount of money that Bill de Blasio was going to have, and I would need it because I wasn't the incumbent. Mm-hmm. And I came out of the box. I raised $4 or $5 million, like right away, lots of supporters, lots of friends. But I didn't calculate there was a giving, in an individual giving limit of $5,000. So I had a lot of wealthy friends who maxed out, and then it just dried up. So I basically ran out of money. And
sure.
That was frustrating, because that was the only reason I would have stopped. But it, with small donations, there's really no actuarial path to raising anywhere near $30 million.
Right.
So I should have just taken the matching funds and would have been, you know, at a dollar for dollar on the incumbent, and would have been fun to get to the general and see what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So obviously running into some challenges on the financing perspective. Mm-hmm. What lessons did you learn from talking to the people, from going through that process and doing everything up until when, you know, you couldn't do anything more?
Learned a lot about how campaigns operate in terms of fundraising and political outreach, and who you should be spending time with, who matters.
Yep.
And it was an amazing learning experience.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you can take that into other things today.
Of course.
Yep. So what are some fundamental tenets or practices that you still put into your work ethic today? So whether that's commercial real estate related, whether that's other personal habits like meditation or working out, what do you do on the day-to-day that have become fundamental tenets that kind of strive and
I think two big ones that we can all probably, you know, look at for ourselves. Number one is I got kicked out of college. I really didn't like school. And but I did everything else at school. I was involved with the fraternity. I was on my sports teams. I did everything but study, because I just never really loved to study. And I got caught one semester short. They gave me a mandatory year off, which turned out to be, on one hand, a massively humiliating, it was midway through my junior year experience. And then, but I went through the stages of grief and denial and the 12 step, whatever that was. and I went home and I'm like, F college, I don't need it anymore. My dad got me a job at a savings bank on Federal Street in Boston through some friend of his. I'm going to become the president of this bank in like 6 months. I'm going to take over the world. And my strategy was, it was a small building on the main financial street in Boston. Sure. 200 people worked there. And I said to myself, I'm going to be the first one in and last one to leave every day. And I did that. I was maniacal. And I had an awakening 4 or 5 months into it that I really probably didn't want to be the bank president and that I better get my butt back to school and finish up. So I started a campaign bombarding the dean of students at Colgate with letters from me, letters from my friends, letters from the bank president I used to want to be, begging to take me back early. And the last week of August, I'm sitting at my clerk desk at the bank, and the phone rings, and it's him. He had never returned my calls. He had never, you know, and he said, well, look, I think it's usually a massive mistake to let kids back in early because they haven't hit bottom, they haven't gone through the process. But he goes, I really think you're probably cured. And and I'm sick of getting letters from your friends and the bank president. So, like, be in my office next week and don't mess this up. And that wasn't the expression that he used.
Yeah.
And
we're paraphrasing.
So I was back. I was back in school. I was able to go and spend my senior year there. Then I had to do a super senior year, which was annoying. But anyway, I got back. But the minute I got back in school, all my friends were like, don't move back into the frat. Don't move back into the frat. That's where you got in trouble. You were too social. But I did move back, but I was a changed, a changed guy.
Sure.
And I went downstairs the first day to the cook in the kitchen, and I said, hey, if you don't mind, I'm going to be here at 6 a.m. for breakfast. I'm going to head to the library in between classes. And by like 11 o'clock, I was getting straight A's. And I realized school really isn't that hard, as long as you do a little work. And then I could go back to all my fun things and still, you know, so I had straight A's the last three semesters in college. And that first person in, last person to leave thing, I've never let that go. And Bob Knackle was a lot like that. We used to compete for who got in first all the time. And he was commuting from New Jersey.
Yeah.
So I think showing up's a big thing.
Yep. I love that. I absolutely love that. So where did that come from, Paul? So what clicked, you know, from you going into that bank and saying, I'm going to be the president and I'm going to get in first and I'm going to be the last to leave? Where did that why come from? What propelled you to make that change and then to also keep that change when you were back in school?
Part of it was just abject humiliation. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're president of your frat and you're captain of your team and you're all of a sudden you're thrown out unceremoniously.
Yep.
That wasn't that fun.
Right.
And so it was driven through deep embarrassment. And, but also, like, the minute I did it and I could see that it worked, I knew that if I had decided to stay at the bank, that I would have done really, really well working that hard.
Sure.
And that I think is a big part of it, you know? And,
right.
And I just kept going with that and it seemed to work, mm-hmm. you know, it you're a good role model for people. They, you know, it's about, you know, the amount of effort that you put into something. It, it was pretty clear to me that if that was one of the fundamental tenets of my, you know, life in business, that I would do okay.
Absolutely. And you clearly saw the success. So I love seeing, you know, kind of you had everything, you were on top of the world, got thrown down, but you didn't let it shake you, right? You said, I'm going to pivot and I'm going to do something else and then I'm going to work hard.
Boy,
right?
I needed to grow up though. I needed I think we all hit some point in our life with that. Mm-hmm. Except for my college roommate was a guy named Jeff Edison, who went right from Colgate to Harvard Business School to starting his own company, to being in the real estate biz and doing very, very well. He never had a point where he needed to grow up. I can never figure that out, but he's still one of my best buddies, even though he's not really human.
Yeah, some people are superhuman, right? But that's awesome. I mean, you took adversity again, right, talking about it, and made it into, you know, a huge tenet in your life. And I think that everyone these days is trying to work smarter, not harder, right? I always hear that, but everyone's trying to do that. So you do have to work harder. You do have to do one more or still be the person. Doesn't matter how much success that you see, still be the first person in and the last one to leave, because you outwork someone, that's going to be the difference between you being first and second potentially. Yeah. Right. So I love hearing that story, and I'm sure our listeners do as well.
I think the second big thing is this, right? It's
what happened?
Yeah. I'm into jujitsu now.
Yes. I heard about the boxing.
Yeah. Boxing was part of my life for a while, but the new thing for the last couple of years is jujitsu, which is Brazilian martial art, but it's a lot like wrestling, which I was a wrestler in school. I'm having a blast with it. I pay 26-year-olds not to hurt me, and I think I owe this guy a raise because he needs to. But having that as part of your life too has always been super important to me because you know, if you discipline yourself to go do that three times a week or four times a week, and then you know, I try and do it kind of the middle of the day, which is a struggle because in the morning I just like to nuzzle up with my coffee and at night I'm the man of 1,000 excuses and or industry events or, but I'll walk out of the office in the middle of the day and get a great workout in and come back and be all showered up and fresh. And it feels great. But also, no matter what kind of morning you had, good or bad, you're back, you're fresh, you're ready to go again. And keeping physically fit and active, and I think maybe the same thing could be for other interests and hobbies that you have that you're really passionate about. So it doesn't have to be athletics, but having that balance between the family and the biz and whatever your personal, you know, athletic or personal hobby is, and being disciplined about it is super important. Make sure, you know.
I think you hit on such a great point for our listeners, right? I mean, that work-life balance is huge, but also just making sure that you're doing something for yourself every day, right? Getting your mind off of it. I love that you're working out in the middle of the day. It's almost like a reset, right? You have kind of 2 days. So if you're fortunate enough to be able to do that and kind of take that time for yourself, I highly recommend it. I love doing it in the middle of the day. Sometimes, you know, days get away from you and you can't do that, or if you're not able to do that, but just making sure that that discipline is there. I love that, you know, putting yourself first, the way that you treat yourself and the care that you put for yourself, then you can spread out to others. I absolutely love that. I do Pilates and kind of work out. I like boxing as well. I'm not like super great at it, but it's so fun. And the reason is because you can only kind of think about that for 45 minutes or an hour, right? Our brains are doing so many different things. But for those 45, 50 minutes, an hour, whatever it is, that's just for you. And it's getting out that frustration and just working out from the physical perspective, but also just the mental health perspective too. That's a huge benefit. So yeah. I love that you just touched on that.
Yep.
Perfect. Well, coming in and kind of transitioning to our second topic here. So by founding B6 after Massey Knackle's acquisition, you essentially returned to the drawing board to start a business from scratch. So tell us about what that experience was like starting from the beginning again after such a successful run.
It's been a radically different experience on a lot of levels from the first business, where for the first years of Massey Knackle, we weren't purposefully growing. We were adding a person here or there. So it was very, very slow organic growth to a point which about 12 or 13 years in, we got very frustrated and contemplating selling the business. But then woke up and realized we would be, we would have given up some of our dreams. And so we finally got about the business of really being, you know, like these business school books where the baker's working in the bake shop, not working on the bake shop. That was us. So once we kicked in, which was way back when, but it was like right after 9/11 happened, 2001, we started recruiting with purpose and with recruiting talent and training if we're hiring en masse. And then just bringing in people to manage and support the business as it grew. We hit a radical growth curve between 01 and 07, the first top of the market. So that was very satisfying. So starting a new business was hyper growth right from the beginning. Sure. We had a vision that was bigger than the first business. But man, B6 has been I love everyone who works there and I've loved every minute of it, but it's been crazy challenging. Crazy challenging. First thing that happened was we opened, first full year was 2019.
Okay.
And the legislature in Albany in New York State changed the rent laws on the million apartments that are regulated in the city, saying basically you can't raise rents and you can't fix up your buildings.
Right.
Which they were trying to help and stabilize life for people who struggle to pay rent, which is an admirable goal. But it had a wild reverse effect, unintended, uncontemplated by the politicians, which was you've taken a $10 million office apartment building and you have made it worth $5 million overnight, because people would buy these buildings, they would buy them on a 4% return, four cap, and drive it to an 8 cap, stabilize it, refinance it, put it on the shelf, keep it long term. Great business plan.
Yep.
And you were able to legally increase rents through vacancy and attrition and increasing and fixing buildings up where you could achieve that. The minute those rules were in place, no one wanted to pay that kind of money anymore. And you're now looking at buying on a 7 or an 8% return because it's not an appealing investment. And inflation is going to erode your return with taxes and operating. So you're buying on an 8 and you're driving it to a 4. Who wants to buy that? So that market froze up. That's about 40% of what we do, which was very, very frustrating. And then COVID hit. So we had 8 to 9 months of zero revenue during COVID. For a startup business, that was like, you know, we were a poster child for PPP money. And then the minute we started coming out of the COVID effects, we had the office market where it is, which is super challenged. Mm-hmm. And then interest rates start spiking up.
Yep.
So it's been an uphill battle, but the people who I've worked with are fantastic. We have a bunch of alums that are there and from the first business, but we've had a good time despite, you know, thinking what's happening next. Are the locusts going to come?
It is always challenging, but you know, one of the things that you definitely did say is just the people that surround you, they're phenomenal. I mean, I've talked to a ton of different team members. They've all been fantastic. So talk to me a little bit about the essential building blocks and the foundation and how you've kind of instilled that culture in the people, whether it was immediately when you were hiring these people or how you just kind of came about with those tenants. So first and foremost, can you explain the philosophy behind building by building and block by block?
You know, deep specialization really is what that means. That's code for discipline. And mm-hmm. I think people always say, the businesses that, you know, you've been lucky to be involved with had a great culture, have a great culture, this one included. I think culture is a byproduct of discipline. And that mm-hmm. doesn't sound really sexy, but if you decide that you want to be hyper-specialized and really focus and have a knowledge that other people don't have of a submarket, mm-hmm. You're going to bring a lot of value to the clients.
Yep.
Because you're going to be able to sell what you need to sell for them and with authority and a knowledge base. So it's all about helping the clients. And I think also internally, we have a lot of discipline about the way we hand business off between each other, which is a challenge, I think. And some of the national companies wrestle with this because they're just so big. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do they pass the ball amongst the team?
Sure.
We have that all delineated very specifically. So I think let's talk about any company, not our company, but any company that wants a culture needs to have people really knowing what they're doing, keeping in their lane, not competing with each other. Mm-hmm. So you end up with this scenario at a company with good culture, that everybody is trying to help each other. They're not competing with each other. And to the extent that revenue generation is a part of the company, which it is in every company, how does that get chopped up in a way that the entire company plays by the rules? Mm-hmm. And so they end up not competing with each other and they end up not negotiating with each other, mm-hmm. which is where a lot of people spend a lot of time at other firms,
yep.
All day long. And who thinks they win a negotiation? Nobody. Right.
Yeah.
So, in any company I've ever been involved with, blessedly, they're a unique team. So when you have the company picnic, they're really happy to be hanging out with each other.
Yep.
Or you have the holiday party, they all, you know, the families love to spend time together and see each other. And they're in each other's weddings and they're godparents to each other's kids. And that's a team to me.
For
and
sure.
That can apply to any business. So I think that's culture.
I couldn't agree more. And back to kind of the things that we've kept talking about is discipline, right? Self-discipline. If you're able to have a discipline with yourself, maybe that's, you know, keeping the promises that you have to yourself and make to yourself. I also think that increases your own confidence, right? If I'm going to go to the gym, if I'm going to wake up at 6 a.m. and get into the office first, you keep doing those things, you're going to increase your own confidence. But those are the people that you want to surround yourself with. And then I think you touched on deep specialization, right? Delegating to the right people, making sure that the team is, you know, delineating between, hey, this is your expertise and I'm going to hand this off, right? I think a lot of brokers sometimes, and there's even a misconception that, you know, you're all competing against each other for deals, whether that's, you know, internally or externally, right? And internally, it should just be, hey, this is my specialty, this is yours. Let's make a culture of helping each other. So I love that you're instilling that in your company.
Yeah, an add-on to that is that if you're hyper specialized and hyper capable, mm-hmm. This is a really funny thing, but your biggest referral source for new business is probably your competitor. Mm-hmm. If you think about sure. it, they will bring you things that you're a specialist in, where you're better serving the client than they are.
Right.
And there's fee sharing with that too, which is nice. Mm-hmm. In most industries, if you're tossing business back and forth, you share it. I would say, and this is a shocking statistic possibly, but 60% of our business comes from a company like Eastill, who's not really in our space, but we can toss business back and forth. They're more an institutional mm-hmm. office and multifamily marketing company. But if you really look at your competitor and say, that's not my competitor, mm-hmm. that's my friend,
right?
A lot of good things can happen.
I love that.
But lacking the specialization, you mm-hmm. can't pull that off.
Right, exactly. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, some of that you're instilling in your team now probably comes from the early days at Massey Knackel. Maybe some of it is different. So what are some of the similarities or differences between that company and then this company now?
Well, the fundamentals of specialization are there. The fundamentals mm-hmm. of fee sharing are there.
Yep.
But, you know, you've got to be on top of the fact that the landscape changes.
Yep.
You know, what is happening politically with multifamily? What's happening with the office market? You've got to know what's happening in the external world and the local economy and what that looks like. And the brokerage landscape changes, mm-hmm. right? The
sure.
Are you in an environment where there's fee pressure, where the external competition is lowering fees to a point that it's, you know, makes it challenging to be a profitable company? I think we're cognizant of those things, and there's always another landscape out there, but you've got to be making sure you're operating efficiently within whatever your current reality is.
Sure.
And I think the residential firms, a lot of whom we admire, have gone down a negative rabbit hole, both buying agents from their competitors mm-hmm. For big checks, mm-hmm. and then they have to have production that's commensurate to make that have been a worthwhile thing, and also paying higher fee splits to the point that the companies are financially challenged. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, you want, if you're either the agent or the owner of the business, you want it to be profitable so you can support the agents in the way that you would want.
Sure.
But if you pay unrealistic higher splits because the external market's headed to a challenging place, mm-hmm. You're all going to suffer. And if you look at the stock price of some of the larger residential companies, they're super challenged now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they just need to resist this temptation kind of to be all things to all people. Mm-hmm. And so you got to consider that you want to be a healthy business.
Right. Absolutely. Mm. And you're kind of touching on a little bit on it here as well, but talk to us about the training that you have with the new, you know, brokers or agents that you bring on board, right? It's not just kind of coming up with everyone and anyone, right? You want the people who are disciplined. You want all of that. How do you train new employees that come on board?
Well, you train them in their pipeline. And again, this is the thing mm-hmm. that's like not so sexy, but we're pipeline managers.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to stuff the pipeline with marketing of each of our agents so that when there's a potential transaction, they're considered to help.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, get to the table. Many, many times we're competing for the business because it's a very saturated brokerage field, and you really need to consistently win the business once you're competing for the business. We kind of like that aspect of it because if the client's really educating themselves about what their options are,
mm-hmm.
A, they're going to learn a lot about the value of the property, which is, you know, a fundamental thing. And B, they're going to learn a lot about people's marketing capabilities and platforms. So the more the client makes the right educated decision, the easier a job is. Because they've gone through the education. They've started their education process about what their building's worth, which is human nature, right? We all need to have a optimistic expectation and then get to reality and execution. But we like that. And then you need to do your job. You need to market the property so it's widely out there in the world, including working with your fellow real estate brokers at other firms. So we train our people in how to prospect, how to present, how to execute, and how to close. And there's a lot to those elements. And I think they're appreciative and grateful, and we've always done this. Because you don't have to be Bob and Paul and make every single mistake in the book. You could be told how to miss a few mistakes or take advantage of, you know, senior people's knowledge, and life can be just a touch easier.
Yes, absolutely. So it's learning from others, either the successes or the failures. I think that's super important, and kind of instilling that and training that into your agents. So talk to us a little bit about how you differentiate with your clients. So once you do win that business, how do you provide the most value to your clients? What differentiates your agents from others, and how do you keep them returning back?
Well, the client almost always wants, in the event of a sale of the property, max proceeds, right? They want the most money they can get. If it's a financing, they want the best financial terms, the best interest rate, the best loan out there. And I think the way that you do that is, I always say like that we're a marketing company, not a brokering company. We tend to be sell side only. We are only sell side only. Landlord representation only, whether it's a sale or a debt placement. And that's a huge advantage that the clients love. Because again, getting back to some of the competitors, they'll represent buyers and tenants and users. And it gets, you know, confusing at best to the clients about who's representing them. Or, you know, outright conflict at worst. So a part of our presentation to our clients is we're completely owner aligned, which they, once they think about that concept, they absolutely love. But we, that's really, you know, I think a way to look at it is, if you think about companies like ours, we're like a Christie's auction house, art auction house, or a Sotheby's auction house, where we're really trying to create, not specifically an auction, because auctions are a single day and you might have a bad day, but you're looking for a crescendo of your marketing efforts where you've got everyone who's potentially a market participant having done their due diligence and homework on the respective property, and you can negotiate back and forth with the top bidders to create that crescendo and to create that auction environment where they're really stepping up and putting their best foot forward. So I think if we look at our business the way the art experts at Sotheby's would look at their business, it looks a lot like their business with the same intent. So if I was talking to a client, that's the way that I would hope that they would look at the services we can provide them. And then getting back to our conversation about fee pressure, they don't really care what they pay you if they think that you're the best executor for them of that crescendo marketing strategy, because our fee is relatively nominal to what they get when they sell the property. So then we avoid fee pressure and they'll pay a fair fee, and we don't get, we don't, you know, we get what we should.
I love that. I love it. It's absolutely. And then going back to that specialization, doing one thing, doing one thing well, and then showcasing that this is what we've done day in and day out over and over again. Mm. And then, you know, making sure that you're the right choice for the job. So that's a great point to hit on. So moving into another topic that I want to cover, on our prep call, you mentioned your passion for mentoring and helping the next generation of CRE professionals grow and succeed, which I love. So how do you work with young people, whether that's within the larger commercial real estate space or even community? Give us a little bit of overview about what you're currently doing to work with folks.
Well, the nice thing about New York City is, unlike a lot of major cities where there are multiple industry associations, mm-hmm. New York City has one monolithic industry association called the Real Estate Board of New York. You mentioned it earlier.
Yep.
REBNY
yep.
is the acronym. And there is a whole world of things you can do to be active there, including coaching, mentoring, teaching, career development. So you can throw yourself at REBNY or any industry association, for those of you who aren't in New York, and do a lot of good helping young people in their jobs. So that's one thing we think about. And then another huge one for me is, where'd you go to college? If you didn't go to college, where'd you go to school? Where'd you go to high school? And there's probably an active alumni association mm-hmm. for that, or both those things, where there are people in the real estate industry. My high school, I went to a small day school in Boston, independent school, and they started a real estate alumni affinity group, and it was massively successful. And it's not a big school, mm-hmm. but it was a bunch of the biggest and best, most active people in Boston in the real estate biz. And they really learned a lot from each other. They benefited from being around each other, and they were all age groups.
Okay.
So you'd get an opportunity to help young people.
Sure.
I would fly to Boston for some of these events that they have from time to time, or I still do. And it's great. And I actually had a hand in coaching my college into getting active into the same thing. So Colgate has a super active real estate alumni affinity group. And that's an avenue where you have, if you went to the same school, you've got almost absolute trust in whoever it is that you're meeting and dealing mm-hmm. with, because you know that they're there for the same benevolent reasons.
Yep.
So besides the industry association where you can get involved and help young people, the school affinity group angle is really, really productive. And in some cases, you know, we hired a lot of people who were from Bob's school, which was Penn, mm-hmm. or my school, which was Colgate, back in the early days when no one knew who we were.
Sure.
But those schools are a well of really good talent.
Yep.
So that's another thing to think about in terms of community involvement, mentoring, that type of thing.
I think those are both great points. So whether our listeners are trying to get more into mentorship, or if they're a mentee that wants to gain mentorship, I think the commercial allegiances in the industry, in their local market, plus collegiate ones, or just, you know, reaching out to schools that you've went to, I think is huge. So for some of those folks who are listening that don't have access to that right now or haven't been involved, give us your insight on what constitution makes for a successful broker, and then conversely, what makes for a successful manager in brokerage? So can you give us your insight on maybe potential differences or similarities between the two?
Yeah, so a star broker producer to us looks like a pro athlete.
Yep.
And not restricted to athletes, because mm-hmm. you know, you can have super talented people who have non-athletic interests and passions and mm-hmm. excellence. But a classic is an athlete as a producer, because if you get back to my pipeline commentary,
mm-hmm.
an athlete knows you don't show up on Saturday and win the game without grinding it out for months and months prior to game day.
Yep.
With very little gratification, a lot of exhaustion and practice and wax on, wax off. And if anyone's seen the Karate Kid movie.
Yep.
Yeah. And so that looks a lot to us like a good candidate. So mm-hmm. when they walk in and someone's got that kind of thing on their resume, even loosely, you know, flags go up and we want that candidate.
Yep.
And they also tend to be anyone who's been on any kind of team, even loosely, again, that just helps. They fit into the team culture.
Sure.
More effectively. I always say a good manager, there a lot of people do player coach. They can manage. They can produce. They can originate business. Maybe a CEO is a good example of someone who should be a rainmaker and a manager. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people don't love both. They love one more than the other, and I think they should stick with whatever it is they mm-hmm. love, because the benefit of them is they're going to be happier. Mm-hmm. The money follows the success and the happiness. So
sure.
to the extent that anyone is concerned about earning a lot, if you're doing what you're passionate about, you will. But I always thought that, you know, I'm really not a sports fan, so I'm just talking without a license. But like Joe Torre was a legendary coach of the Yankees. Mm-hmm. And Joe Torre was a good player. Mm-hmm. But Joe Torre was the guy who could coach Jeter and A-Rod and all these old stars. And they all needed a coach. Mm-hmm. They all wanted a coach, even though they were stars.
Right.
And he lived vicariously through their success. A pro baseball manager is not paid like the star players are. But he doesn't really care. He or mm-hmm. she doesn't really care, because he or she knows that that's the way it is, and they're happy being a coach.
Sure.
So if you're happy being a coach, you have to think about, what's my leadership style? Mm-hmm. And I think the best one is servant leader, where yeah. no one ever says, you know, you're going to do it this way because I'm the boss. No one
right.
buys that.
Right.
No. Or because I said so, or because mm-hmm. I signed your paycheck. I mean,
right.
I've heard all these managerial blunder expressions. But I think a pure, great manager is a servant leader
yeah.
who puts everyone ahead of themselves, mm-hmm. Just thinks about the best interests of every team member on their field, gets them to play in unison. So if you're wondering if you are at an inflection point and you're thinking about taking a managerial job, and there's some allure to it. Everyone kind of thinks, oh, it must be cool to be the boss. Not every day, not really. but if that's what you really want to do, and if that's
yeah.
the role that you really want to play,
sure.
then it's worth it, and
right.
you're good. But I always push people to think about, there are going to be inflection points in your life and in your career, whether you're going to be choosing the production, if you will, loosely, because mm-hmm. every business is different, or client facing or whatever, or whether you really want to manage the business.
Mm-hmm.
And you should really think about what makes you happy and pick that direction, not mm-hmm. what, you know, not taking a job because it's got a cool title.
Right.
Titles are like, you know, I think they're worthless.
Absolutely. And I love that kind of take on everything, right? A lot of people will say that they are, you know, player coach, and some people can, you know, do that really well. But I do think that
rare.
Job is hard.
It's very rare.
Right? It is rare to be good at absolutely both things, because it does take a certain skill set to be, you know, that producer or that manager, right? And I love the servant leader. You know, I say this to my team too, is I work for you and we work together, mm-hmm. right? I think the because I said so's of the world work really well in parenting, right? My mom has said that multiple times, and we've all heard it. Hey, why do I have to do this? Because I said so, right? Why do I have to go to bed, right? And that maybe works as a kid, but not as a leader, right, in our adult world. So I appreciate that and that viewpoint on everything. So speaking from an understanding of the current state of commercial real estate and the current state of the macroeconomic headwinds as we head into 2024, how are you advising young professionals today? So what should they know going into brokerage or commercial real estate? is now a good time? How should they start approaching their new careers? Give us a little bit of insight maybe to listeners who are thinking about getting into brokerage or commercial real estate for the first time, or are new in the business, or just kind of facing some of these challenges that you've went through multiple, you know, times throughout your career.
Yeah, first thing is you can't time the market. Mm-hmm. You cannot figure it out. I do think, and this is going to be hard to hear, that it's nice if the market's really good when you're young and starting out, because mm-hmm. you get a taste of what good is.
Yeah.
And that's very helpful for when it's not good.
Right.
Because you remember, sure. Hang in, it'll get better. So I have sympathy for a lot of people who have started in the business in the last 4 or 5 years, because it hasn't been good. Mm-hmm. It's been low velocity for a multitude of reasons, in terms of turnover of sales and leasing for that matter. So you can't time the market. But I think if you really love this business, boy, you're going to like it when it's good. So it's worth hanging in for and grinding it out at the beginning, which you're going to have to do anyway, mm-hmm. and learn. So I would just dive in anytime you want to enter the market, and it'll work out.
Absolutely. I mean, the market is so cyclical. Commercial real estate is so cyclical. And I've heard this from multiple people. The time to get into the market is now, right? Put your boots on the ground. Do your revenue generating activities. Do your calls, because it's all going to pay off, especially when the market does increase. So yeah, I love hearing that.
Some client used the expression that we're in a violently cyclical time. I was like, wow, I've never heard that expression, but that's a good one.
That's a good one. I'm going to take that. I'll credit you and your client. Yeah. But that's a good one. From your vantage point, having experienced, right, several market cycles, maybe now we're in more of a violently cyclical market. Mm. What are your thoughts on the current market? Where do you see opportunity? Give us your insight there.
Well, every submarket's a little different in terms of what's going on. New York's super challenged on the office side because we're half empty, mm-hmm. Which I think is a fad that's going to evaporate. And people argue the other side of that with me vigorously. But mm-hmm. I think the work from home thing, if you think about what you're hearing from every major CEO, they all know it's a fad and they all know mm-hmm. it's not good. And people are slowly embracing that. But the Jamie Dimons of the world, who run JP Morgan, has been consistently banging the drum to get folks back for his team. Ken Griffith from Citadel made a big announcement a month ago that said, we made $22 billion this year because we came to work.
Yeah.
And, a blunt statement on what he values in terms of the way we should operate. And those people are great to hear, mm-hmm. Because we really need to get back at it. Now, you know, I'm not insensitive to, because we've always had people working with us at any of our companies who have special life circumstances where they're the primary breadwinner, single mm-hmm. parent, you know, whatever it is. And we've always made that work for people, and I think that's a great thing. So
Sure. Some
of this work from home is not going away, nor should it go away. And again, based on circumstances and the way people are able to operate, but generally, it's going to go away. So I think the office segment is probably a massive buy opportunity. And if you think about the fact that the Fortress Investment Group bought $1 billion of Capital One office building loans 2 weeks ago, that's a bell going off. That is something that tells you that there are smart people who are investing in office in a very efficient, effective way. And you're going to look back at that move saying, boy, were they smart. Mm-hmm. So on the multifamily side, it's super challenged. Signature Bank is selling $39 billion worth of multifamily loans into the New York City market. The FDIC is mm-hmm. Selling the former Signature Bank loans.
Sure.
So I think there's going to be a swirl of velocity in that market. I gave a talk at a real estate industry association, the Young Men's Women's Real Estate Association. It's a sister organization of REBNY. I gave a talk about a year and a half ago. And I said, and I was a little nervous because I was on uncharted ground, but I said, I think we're you can have recessions that are industry specific. Mm-hmm. And I said at that time that I thought that we were in a recession. Mm-hmm. And for all the reasons that I've delineated that we've been in, and I think that turns out to have been right.
Right.
That we've been in a very, very challenging time across the board, in multifamily, in office, in retail. And I think it's going to end about halfway through 24. I think we're going to come racing out with more velocity, more investment, interest rates stabilizing. I can feel it happening. Mm-hmm. Exactly when it will be during 24 is hard to predict, but it feels just like the way we felt in 2010 when we were coming out of the Great Recession, where we knew the market was going to turn, and it did, but it was right. all the back half of the year. Mm-hmm. So halfway through 2010, we were losing sleep and nervous. I think we'll probably have the same year this year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's awesome just to see your positive outlook on everything, especially from work from home. I think that it is really advantageous for a lot of folks to do that. I think it will stay a little bit, but seeing more and more people going back into the office, you know, Google's requiring employees to go back into the office. And once you have big companies like that saying, other people will follow suit and, you know, kind of come into that
think
realm.
About it. Zoom is requiring their people right. to come to work. What does that tell you?
What does that tell you? Exactly. So yeah. I love the positive outlook. Any general advice that you would pass along to those getting started in commercial real estate or out there to your peers?
I think the average kid changes jobs 4 times in the first 10 years. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. My son came to me when he was a junior in college and he said, Dad, is it weird that I don't know what I want to do? And I said, no, that would make you normal. So if you're one of those kids who isn't, you know, exactly sure of what they want to do, just keep trying to find the spot that's really the thing for you. Maybe look ahead and say, as you meet people, who's 5 years ahead of me who I admire and I want to be? Yep. That's a good measuring stick for where you might like to go.
Sure.
And then if you end up with a first career job or a first couple of career jobs where it didn't precisely work, there's some real benefit to knowing what boxes you don't want to be in.
Yep.
So look at all those experiences as very beneficial and just keep looking.
Mm-hmm. And I think going back to your beginning point, you know, with making a lot of mistakes is be able to fail. Right. Yeah. And try out a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's a guarantee to happen. Yeah. And when you're in those inflection points, this is pretty basic, but like embrace it. Right. Mm-hmm. Go see 100 people. Go learn more about whatever industry you want to be in. Because every time we've been at that inflection point, it's better to have been thoughtful and purposeful and you end up in a happier place.
Yep. Mm. Absolutely. Well, a ton of advice that you shared with us today, Paul. Before we let you go, any parting words of wisdom, any advice, anything else that you'd want to share with our listeners?
No, I think if you're in the real estate business, we're really going to be heading into good times. A huge takeaway from prior market upheavals has been these things begin and these things end. Mm-hmm. Very definitively. Yep. And I think you're going to see that play out sooner than later. And I think everyone will be, you know, really happy about that. But appreciate the work that you all do. And thanks for having me here today.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you so much. I love it. And those parting words, this too shall pass. Right? Mm-hmm. Amazing. Thank you so much. We know that you're so busy, so we really, really appreciate sitting down with us and taking the time here today.
Cool.
If our audience wants to get in touch, how can they find you? LinkedIn, email, give us all of the details.
Any and all my information's out there. Call my cell. Don't be shy. Especially young people looking for, you know, career advice. Love to hear from you. We're totally informal and easy, so just call us.
I love it. Pick up the phone and call everyone, you know, that's such the industry that we're in. It's a people relationship built industry. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to sit down and for all of our listeners to give you a call. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexy.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexy podcast on your favorite podcast app or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexy for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, and we'll see you next time.